Another day, on getting into my train at the flats, I missed a volume of Popular Science. I think it was on some recent discoveries in biochemistry, which I had carried with me to read on the way. I thought no more about it till I got into the sleigh again that evening and saw the book in Frome's hand.
"I found it after you were gone," he said.
I put the volume into my pocket and we dropped back into our usual silence. But as we began to crawl up the long hill from Corbury Flats to the Starkfield Ridge, I became aware in the dusk that he had turned his face to mine. "There are things in that book that I didn't know the first word about," he said. I wondered less at his words than at the queer note of resentment in his voice. He was evidently surprised and slightly aggrieved at his own ignorance. "Does that sort of thing interest you?" I asked.
"It used to."
"There are one or two rather new things in the book. There have been some big strides lately in that particular line of research." I waited a moment for an answer that didn't come. Then I said, "If you'd like to look the book through, I'd be glad to leave it with you." He hesitated, and I had the impression that he felt himself about to yield to a stealing tide of inertia. Then,
"Thank you, I'll take it,"
he answered shortly. I hoped that this incident might set up some more direct communication between us. Frome was so simple and straightforward that I was sure his curiosity about the book was based on a genuine interest in its subject. Such tastes and acquirements in a man of his condition made the contrast more poignant between his outer situation and his inner needs, and I hoped that the chance of giving expression to the latter might at least unseal his lips. But something in his past history, or in his present way of living, had apparently driven him too deeply into himself for any casual impulse to draw him back to his kind. At our next meeting he made no allusion to the book, and our intercourse seemed fated to remain as negative and one-sided as if there had been no break in his reserve. Frome had been driving me over to the flats for about a week, when one morning I looked out of my window into a thick snowfall. The height of the white waves massed against the garden fence and along the wall of the church showed that the storm must have been going on all night, and that the drifts were likely to be heavy in the open. I thought it probable that my train would be delayed, but I had to be at the powerhouse for an hour or two that afternoon, and I decided, if Frome turned up, to push through to the flats and wait there till my train came in. I don't know why I put it in the conditional, however, for I never doubted that Frome would appear. He was not the kind of man to be turned from his business by any commotion of the elements, and at the appointed hour his sleigh glided up through the snow like a stage apparition behind thickening veils of gauze. I was getting to know him too well to express either wonder or gratitude at his keeping his appointment, but I exclaimed in surprise as I saw him turn his horse in a direction opposite to that of the Corbury Road.
"The railroad's blocked by a freight train that got stuck in a drift below the flats," he explained as we jogged off into the stinging whiteness.
"But look here, where are you taking me then?"
"Straight to the junction, by the shortest way," he answered, pointing up Schoolhouse Hill with his whip.
"To the junction in this storm? Why, it's a good 10 miles.
"The bay'll do it if you give him time. He said you had some business there this afternoon. I'll see you get there."
He said it so quietly that I could only answer, "You're doing me the biggest kind of a favor."
"That's all right," he rejoined.